Welcome to the Farcast, bringing you insights into Wall Street, Washington, and the world. Now here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome to the Farcast. I am Michael Farr. Thanks so much for joining us again this week. It is the ninth day of May. We're moving into the second month of the second quarter, and the year is continuing apace. The Dow Industrial Average, a lot of people still want to discount it, want to pay attention to the S&P 500, as they rightly should, but it is our still oldest bellwether out there. It's been kind of on a tear. Dow's been doing really well. We've had a pullback that's the last 5 or 6 days, but it's been, we'll take any uptake we can get after a really not so great April. Stocks are doing what stocks should do. They're pricing future expectations. They're pricing earnings growth based on what investors see as an economy that seems to be reasonably strong. The economy seems to be reasonably strong. Stock prices are holding up. The misses are getting punished. And misses get punished when stock prices are high. And for the pullback in April, we're still near all-time highs. And multiples are still 20 times earnings. And those that can promise above-average earnings growth typically get above-average prices. They get premiums. And if those earnings disappoint, those stocks take it right in the neck. We've seen that. Still and yet, overall, things seem to be fine. 10-year Treasury rallied awfully nicely, got down into the 4.4%. Now 4.5%. Historically, folks, these interest rates are still very low. The cost of money is relatively low. I know what you're going to say. Tell that to a mortgage, first-time home buyer, Farr. You're right. That 7% mortgage is a good deal higher than it's been in the last 5 to 10 years. Historically, going back to when I was in my salad days, we were all above 8-9% on mortgages. So again, relatively, these things aren't awful. And these rates are not choking the economy. Jay Bryson made a great point last week, though. If the Fed stays steady at this 5.25% rate and inflation comes down, the real rate of interest actually goes up and becomes more constraining, restraining, and it's still tightening. What does that mean? Wait a minute. That just sounds wonky and my eyes are glazing over. I hate it when you talk like that, Farr. You ought to see the expression on my wife's face right now, folks. She at this hour of the morning, she just hates it when I talk at all. But this is how I make my money, honey. This is how I do it. Okay, sorry. If the rate is 5% and inflation is 5%, then the real rate is zero. If inflation is 3% and the real rate and the Fed rate is 5%, then the real rate is 2. So if inflation goes down to 2, then the real cost of money becomes 3%, and that's when the Fed may have to follow it down. That's when it can be more constraining, can put heavier pressure on the brakes of the economy just as inflation goes away. It hasn't abated yet, and Jay Powell said, okay, but overall, we still think we're moving in the right direction, and a couple of numbers that blip up to the upside do not a trend make, so we're going to stick to our guns, and we're going to be patient and watch. And everything else seems to be going okay. Unemployment ticked up a little bit. We'll see where it goes from there, but 3.9%, still awfully low. What does it mean as we cover Wall Street, Washington, and the world on the Farcast? Well, we're going to ask Jim Labenthal from Cerity Partners, of course. He's the smartest guy we get to talk to. Good morning, Jim, and welcome back.
Michael, thank you for your wonderful welcome, your kind compliments. I sure hope you know smarter people than me. That feels like a low bar to clear.
I really don't. You're kind of it, Jim. You're the smartest guy I know, and grateful to know you. So now that tells you a lot about my world, I guess, Jim. But tell us what you think's going on in these markets and investing and how the year's unfolding. Do you sell in May and go away?
Well, I think we're in a weirdly calm moment right now. And I always, when we do this, I listen to your intro and I think about what item do I really want to seize upon? And Michael, I think you'll probably agree that we're tired of talking about the Fed, inflation rates, 10-year treasury, Fed funds futures, all that sort of stuff. We're in this weird calm period where the economy seems just fine. I heard you talk about the uptick in unemployment. That's factual. But of course, initial jobless claims would make it clear that the labor market is pretty strong right now. Profit growth is better than expected. Things look pretty good. Now, what folks, I think you should take away from this is occasionally you have a moment like this where you can wake up in the morning and not worry. But it doesn't last. And I can't tell you, and Michael can't tell you what the catalyst is going to be. All I can say is enjoy it while it lasts. If you had to, you know, sort of force me to take a guess, I would say next week's CPI and PPI, you know, the first inflation readings, direct inflation readings for the month of April, for the second quarter, those might spark some fireworks. I actually think they're likely to come in a little softer than expectations.
Jim, so you think the CPI, you think the economic data is going to start to slow down a little bit, and that'll give the Fed room to ease?
I do, Michael. You know, there's a few points that we can look at here.
Hang on, Jim. Do you expect them to? I mean, I still don't expect the Fed to do anything for the rest of the year. And for those of you who are saying, I wish you'd quit talking about the Fed far, I'm sorry. This is important because markets have been pricing in. They started the year pricing in 7 or 8 cuts for the year, and they were ebullient saying, geez, we're off to the races because the Fed's going to give us a lot of cheap money. And the Fed has been saying consistently, you're the only ones who seem to think so, and not so much, and we're going to stick to our guns. Does it happen this year, Jim? Or I don't see a reason why Jay Powell doesn't sit on his hands and gets caught by the election and doesn't do anything until maybe December.
Look, you very well could be right. I mean, what you're saying is not ludicrous at all. And also, folks, I apologize for once again talking about the Fed. I mean, we've been doing this now for 2.5 years. I'm a little tired of it, but it still matters. It still matters. Michael, I think 1 to 2 and probably 2 cuts this year is likely. You get 1 in September, 1 maybe in December. I agree with you, though, that Jay Powell is probably looking at this situation and saying the economy looks just fine. We don't see any signs of stress in the banking system. Sure, you know, commercial real estate's hanging out there, but it's not showing up in terms of distressed equity levels in the regional banking sector, which is where I would look for it. So he's not seeing a real reason to cut other than what you were referring to in your intro, that as inflation comes down, the real rate of the Fed funds level becomes more and more restrictive. And that may not be what they want. I mean, look, a couple of things here. One, if you look overseas, you are starting to see rate cuts. Now, I know Sweden's central bank is not necessarily the guiding star that we usually follow, but they did cut this week, and that is the first. The ECB is looking like they're going to cut soon. Inflation in Europe, by the way, is lower, at least as measured, than it is here in the United States. And again, in the States, things that point to lower inflation, used car prices, market prices for rents, things like that. So I do think you'll get those cuts just based on inflation softening. But those predictions earlier this year of 6+ cuts, those were predicated on a disastrous economic outcome that did not come to pass.
Right. So, Jim, let's go right into investing here for our final 3 minutes or so. And let's talk about what you do with portfolios and what we're hearing from clients. I know our listeners are always interested in that. So as I'm hearing from clients, I've got clients telling me they want more risk. I've got clients who are saying, what if, isn't there like a chip ETF out there, an AI ETF? Can't we add? I don't want to add to my fixed income at all here. We're hearing those sorts of things. And then I don't know if you're hearing that. And then I've got a follow-up question right after that. So let me give you that one first.
Yeah, well, look, if you're looking for risk, a lot of people are going to say, okay, well, what about tech? What about AI? What about chips? I mean, I'll simply point out that the ChatGPT bombshell happened 18 months ago. And in, equity markets time frame, that's like a long, long time ago, long folks, time. Where I think you can find very reasonably priced investments with good growth prospects are frankly outside of technology. So more of the cyclical stuff. Take a look at traditional discretionary. Take a look at materials, energy. Even after the good year we've been having this year, you're starting to see natural gas prices come up, and that's the next leg higher for energy equities, that is. And lastly, but I might have led with this, small caps. If this economy is going to continue to chug along, that means that the top line revenues for small caps are going to grow, and they're going to grow more than expected because expectations are very low for small caps. At 14 times this year's earnings, there's a good opportunity to buy small caps and get a good bang for your buck when you buy them.
Yeah. Okay. Well, and I think you do have to look at those things. And I think you always have to say, let's try and hit them where they ain't. I want to tell you a couple of things that I'm thinking about, and I'd love to hear about a problem in your portfolio with which you might be wrestling. And I'm going to try and do this anonymously. I've taken a look at a pharmaceutical company that has a GLP-1, one of these weight loss drugs. Their drug is not Ozempic. It's one of the other ones. And that stock is up over 150% or so in about a year, about 150% in a year. So it's doubled, more than doubled in a year, this particular stock. Now, it looks stupidly expensive. And then you've seen stocks do this before. The prospects for this drug go up and down. There's competition out there. Haven't trimmed a share, and I think, well, maybe I should just leave this one in my portfolio personally for my great-grandchildren and never touch it and just let it go up and down. On the other hand, I could take my original investment off the table and still have more than I started with, thereby limiting, of course, some more fabulous upside. How do you square something like that when a product's doing well, the share price is stupid high, and yet the prospects are remarkable?
Well, Michael, very well as I do, that part of the business we're in is managing the psychology of our clients and, frankly, ourselves.
Yes.
So the right answer scientifically may be hold your position, okay? And 3 years from now, if you could just time warp 3 years ahead, it maybe is going to look like a fabulous investment. The problem is that time frame between now and 3 years from now, there's going to be all these ups and downs. And managing, again, not just our client's psychology, but our own psychology, leads me to often say, when you've got a great winner like that, you will feel really good if you trim a little bit. You don't have to take your whole investment out. And by that, I mean your cost basis, nor sell the position entirely. But if you trim it, you have the beauty of, if the stock goes down, you can say to yourself, pat yourself on the back, you trimmed it. If it goes up, you can say to yourself, I've still got a very nice position and I'm happy with it. It's the psychology that sometimes makes life a lot easier to live.
Jim Labenthal is a partner at Cerity Partners, CNBC contributor, and one of the smartest guys I get to ever talk to. And by the way, of course, one of the nicest damn guys you ever want to meet. Thank you so much, Jim.
It's a pleasure always, and thank you, Michael.
We're going to be back with Dan Mahaffey. Hey, Mike Johnson survived. When we come back, please stay with us.
Thank you for joining us this week on The Farcast. Now it's time for political analyst Dan Mahaffey and your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back. Dan Mahaffey, vice chairman of the Dr. Scholl Foundation, also of the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, a Washington think tank, and the senior political analyst on The Farcast. Welcome back, Dan.
Good morning, Michael. Great to be talking with you.
Good to be talking with you. Hey, Dan, is Washington returning to some sorts of sane normal? I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene lost her bid to oust Mike Johnson. There's a little bipartisan coming together to find some sort of a middle, which, hey, I think that's what the founding fathers and the Constitution actually prescribe. So do we stand a chance of things working? And when will we have heard the last from Marjorie Taylor Greene and AOC? I'm not being partisan. I hate the fringes. Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, Michael, thank you. I would say the question I now ask is rhetorically, what is the overlap of Farcast listeners and professional wrestling fans? Because the term I'm about to use, kayfabe, comes to mind, which is the term in professional wrestling for all the back and forth behind the scenes, the story, the heels, the heroes, the all the good guys and
what's
bad
the word?
Guys.
What's
kayfabe?
The word?
Kayfabe. And it's
kayfabe.
The term.
And it's a contraction of what? Or it's a
Business term, term of art in professional wrestling. And
okay.
That's what I think
gonna,
we saw with this.
I'm going to tell you that 100% of the Farcast listeners just learned a new word and none of them follow professional wrestling. If you, dear listeners, if you follow professional wrestling and you knew what that word meant, would you send Harry a note, please? Dan and I are going to have a bet about this later on. Go ahead, Dan.
We're going to see exactly what this Venn diagram is of Farcast listeners and professional wrestling fans.
Right.
So this, though, has been a lot of that. We knew she didn't have the votes to get him out. The Democrats have made that clear. She wanted there to be the television moment, the calling the vote to get on the record of who's going to be there. With or without standing alongside Mike Johnson or not, and to make it clear that he required Democratic votes to stay the speaker. That was her main goal. Now for Johnson, he remains speaker. A lot of the threat is now tabled. It's clear there's no real desire by most of the House. As we looked at this vote, I think it was around 380 members who said keep Johnson. Last week, I was saying there's roughly that number who just want to keep the House working. You see that, and then what you have is a sense of, let's just get to the election. Let's get these few things done, like the FAA bill they're arguing over, Dulles versus Reagan, as you know, that's traditional Washington politics,
yes,
at least.
Yes.
Beyond that, it's tempered this, but allowed the fringes, as you say, to have their moment in the television, that little bit of WWE pop as someone went, oh my God, that's Marjorie Taylor Greene's music.
Okay. So, all right. So fine. Congress, he's there to stay. Everybody's still making noise. Business as usual. Nothing much gets done over the summer. Is that what you're telling me? When's our
No, because we've put everything that we need to get done. All the stuff that is now here, again, those final things that if they don't get agreement, they'll just push to a continuance or a resolution to get it past the election.
Okay. We have Stormy Daniels testifying in New York about, I'm reading things in the Washington Post that I cannot read out loud in mixed company, that mm-hmm. she is saying that they are discussing in this trial.
I'm willing to pay hush money to just stop seeing any of this.
I think you could raise a hell of a lot of money. I know I probably, we could raise a lot of money even on the Farcast just to get them to shut up about this horrible, sordid stuff. My favorite line, though, in the Post yesterday morning was, after this litany of complaints about this sexual encounter with former President Trump, Stormy Daniels added, but the encounter was brief. the encounter, or very brief, something like that. I mean, how to take a shot when you're, anyway.
Yeah, but these legal cases are anything but brief. We see the more serious ones being delayed by the Supreme Court matter, the classified documents.
Well, yeah, and the effect seems that President Trump's ratings go up in the face of this stuff.
Right. And
Biden's dropping like a rock in the polls. What's going on?
I think Biden continues to face the questions about his age, competency, and the overall economic headwinds.
And there are more rumors that there's going to be some big change at the Democratic convention, which always arise whenever you have a president with questionable popularity. And they never drop out. These guys never quit. They're like cockroaches. They never go away. Look at the president. You can love the president. You can love President Biden, love him. You can't tell me that he isn't past the expiration date on the milk carton for best use. I mean, you just, no, come on. This is an elderly man who's struggling, and this is the most important, powerful job in the world. Dan, what am I getting wrong, and how many people did I just really piss off?
Well, look, I think you're saying what a lot of Democrats and others say behind the scenes, a lot say it openly. There's just no clear alternative right now. The bench, as it were, is empty. And as you note, too, and we've discussed, once you're in office, no one really wants to give that up. The other parts where people talk about conventions and stuff like that right now, bar something that happens involving health or something of that nature, you know, the type of things that we can't account or control for, at least on the political timeline, I would say those things about the convention or a replacement or, you know, put down the bourbon and stop watching West Wing reruns because it's just not going to work that way.
I'm not sure that. Okay, stop watching West Wing rerun. Don't put down your bourbon. God, have you ever needed it? You probably need it now, and you're going to need more of it as we.
But I think to circle back to the final point on these cases is unless you're in that Pacific Island atoll with the guy who thinks the war is still going on, most American voters have a clear understanding of Biden's age and Trump's character. These are not unknowns to be established right now. The one thing that I think just still does raise some concern for the Trump world is that you continue to see Nikki Haley getting 15-20% of primaries. She's still not running it anymore.
Israel, Dan, the president is under fire over what's going on in Israel and how he's handling it. I don't know what anyone expects the president to do. I'm not taking sides here. I just don't know what you do in a conversation with Bibi Netanyahu about him defending his country and how you think about him in his mind defending his country and his people and trying to remove a threat to the Israeli state. Tell me.
I understand that. I understand the importance of the allyship. At other times, there needs to be reminders which nation is the superpower and which nation is the client state.
And are any of those, it seemed to be falling on deaf ears. And does Israel really need our money at this point to pursue what they're doing in the Gaza, in Palestine? I don't think they do. I think they're pretty set for a while.
They're set for a while in terms of their own capabilities. But look, when it comes to resupply of munitions, advanced capabilities, and really what Biden was focusing on with these holds, let's be clear, it's not a widespread arms halt. It's simply high explosive bombs. And they said they weren't going to give them to the IDF because they want to know how they're going to be using high explosive bombs, perhaps in urban areas. So that's the hold. And what it reflects, though, is not just what I get the sense of public concern, but even in Congress, numbers of senators who talk about needing to condition aid to Israel. It's not just what you see on the campuses that has kind of taken away the attention and sucked a lot of the oxygen on this discussion out. It's that American politicians are beginning to question, too, how Israel's handling this.
Yeah. Let's shift. Ukraine. Russia's making a lot of noise. And will Ukraine's still getting some weapons. They're going to get more weapons. They've gotten their funding. Are we in a delicate period or do we plow through this?
And we're in a very delicate period. I think in Ukraine, it's rather precarious as the Russians try to amass for a summer offensive of their own. I think with timely deliverance of U.S. and allied assistance, we can dull that. The Russians are going to go for, mass human wave, mass tank type assault.
Are we still talking about this a year from now, Dan?
Of course. I think we are, unless you see a rapid change. It's a stalemate.
It's a stalemate, and it just keeps going on. This is the new, it's not a Vietnam because we don't have our troops there, but it is that sort of conflict that just won't go away.
And perversely, too, you see what's happened with the Russian economy. By becoming a war economy, Russia has mobilized to a war economy unlike Europe or the U.S. has, you know, even thought of. So their economy now is actually even more dependent on being in this war to stay functioning than the previous Russian economy.
Now, that's really important, ladies and gentlemen, what Dan just said, that the Russian economy is becoming war dependent. Give me another minute on that. How is the Russian economy now more war dependent than it was before? What are the shifts from what the Russian economy was? Tell me where it was and tell me where we are, and tell me how hard it would be to go back to being a non-war economy, which we hope happens at some point.
Well, largely the John McCain's pejorative, I believe, of Russia as a gas station with weapons held true. And what happened with the embargoes is basically the gas station got shut down. You see the collapse of the of Gazprom and others. Yes. They have the resources, but not the ability to export them. Even, you know, they can't clear the oil in rupees with India. They don't have the infrastructure to get it to China. You know, that could change in time, but for now, they've largely had to focus on weapons production, munitions, tanks, vehicles, as well as the conscription of males. So all of that has shifted the economy away from energy, while also deprioritizing things like the consumer economy, not that there was ever much of that, as well as a agricultural autarky. You see Russians now trying to replace Italian mozzarella and Parmesan with their own farming, for example. So Russia has developed an economy cut off and geared towards war. And in ways, as we saw Putin getting his newest, latest term in office, that economy is largely geared to continuing this war, not stopping it.
Okay. We have Xi Jinping active in Europe. What's he doing?
He's trying to prevent Beijing's biggest fear, which is that there's a Washington-Europe alignment on China. The more the U.S. and Washington, the U.S. and Europe talk together on issues of China, on trade, on global security, that makes China nervous. What she's trying to do is get some concessions from the Europeans, although they're in some ways angrier than us on some of the trade, electrical vehicle rules, things like that. But he's also looking at areas, you know, Xi Jinping, like Putin, sees Viktor Orban in Hungary as a useful Trojan horse. So he'll be visiting Hungary.
I'm very close to a lot of the law enforcement folks in Washington, D.C. because of Heroes. And Heroes is one of, I think, the best charities to which anyone can contribute. Heroes takes care of the families of the fallen first responders, police and firefighters and EMTs and others. And they cover park police and Secret Service and everything else. And you're never going to hear about them. And they don't. Heroes refuses to take the widows and children and march them in front of television cameras. They do all of this very anonymously, very privately, but they help pay off mortgages. And they put the children of these folks who give up their lives in the line of duty, put all the children through the college of their choices. It's just a wonderful organization and the right kind of charity. That they're not being boastful. They don't stand up and tell you what they're doing. They just show up and do it. So Heroes, great charity in Washington, D.C. And I've gotten to know a lot of these police chiefs, and the police chiefs always say, we follow the money in every crime. We want to follow the money. And when you look at influence, political influence around the world, yes, as the former head of the Mossad said to me years ago in Israel, he said, the United States is very strong militarily, but your economic influence is far greater, far greater. And when your economy goes into peril, you put the rest of the world into flux. The rest of the world goes into flux. So a lot of what we do economically in Europe is very, very important through NATO and other causes. Our money stabilizes Europe. Xi Jinping is giving up on his economy and the focus on economic growth because he wants to pursue a great China ideal. Stupid, Mr. Premier, stupid. But if he doesn't back up his words with dollars throughout Europe, or yuan, if you will, which is Chinese currency, how much influence can he have, Dan?
Well, that's again where we see the money going into the Balkan countries, the Eastern European countries. That's where China's tried to do some of this, Greece and Italy as well. But there has been European pushback. It's led by increasingly the Germans and the French. We see raids on Chinese companies. We see Germans now looking at counter-espionage, counterintelligence operations against the Chinese. So this is all going on in the background. The Europeans, if anything, are becoming more aware. I think your discussion, though, of U.S. power, one, the economic power, maintaining that. But you also talked about, I'll build on your analogy, heroes works quietly in the background. What the United States needs to do is not always be presenting a hyperbolic Chinese threat, but just letting China's actions speak for themselves. And in that way, we'll get more, I think, alignment with Europe in the long run, rather than rushing over after Xi Jinping's been there with our hair on fire, just screaming, China's bad, China's bad, China's bad. That doesn't work either.
Hair on fire is never good for stock markets. The economy is still expanding in Europe and in the U.S., certainly much more in the U.S., not so much in China. So I think this is the undercurrent of what's going on around the world. We're going to continue to watch. We're going to continue to hear what Dan thinks. Dan Mahaffey, thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be right back hearing about economics from the conference board and why whether you like your job or not really does matter to the economy and whether it's going to affect whether we grow or not. When we come back on the Farcast, please stay with us.
Michael Farr and the Farcast are proud to support Heroes, Inc. Heroes supports the spouses and children of law enforcement officers and firefighters who gave their lives in the line of duty to the greater Washington, D.C. community. Their singular goal is to honor the supreme sacrifice made by these individuals by caring for their families. Heroes' work begins within 24 hours of the tragic loss and continues indefinitely. We invite you to learn more about Heroes' mission at heroes.org. We hope that you will consider supporting Heroes as they endeavor to honor those who protect us. That's heroes.org. Heroes, here for you, here for good. And now, back to the Farcast and your host, Michael Farr. Thank you for joining us on the Farcast. And now, back to your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back. We are here on May the 9th doing the Farcast this week, as we do, and cover Wall Street, Washington, and the world. We had a good session with Jim Labenthal as he's trying to figure out what next in markets. He's not sure that markets care, but he's sure that something's coming, mostly because investors are now getting to the point that they don't think much is coming. You can count on it. He's right about that, in my experience. Dan Mahaffey still explaining to us what's going on in Capitol Hill and why Xi Jinping is trying to make progress economically in Europe. Good luck, Mr. Premier Xi Jinping. Unless you're writing checks, I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think it's going to happen. But as we continue to bring you insiders from around the world, a new one for us this morning. We are absolutely thrilled to present to you Alan Schweier, who is at the conference board. He is the principal researcher in the Human Capital Center for the conference board. He's written 5 books. He's been recognized as being among the most 100 influential people in HR and talent. So this guy has chops. There was an article, ladies and gentlemen, fabulous article over the weekend in, of all places, the Washington Post, but it explained why entrepreneurial efforts over the past 3 or 4 years during COVID are driving productivity. And productivity, one of the 2 elements in GDP growth. One is the number of employees, and we look at immigration and things, and that's been doing okay. But we saw a jump in productivity in 2023. That's great for U.S. GDP growth. It didn't come from AI. Fabulous. AI's helping, but we really haven't seen the real impacts that I think we're going to see from AI. I think they're going to be more fabulous. But what we saw was new businesses that started because people became entrepreneurial again during COVID. So when we go back to the people element of economics, when we go back to the people part of the equation in economics, I go back to my firm thesis that the American dream is still the backbone key of the U.S. economy. It is the foundation of the U.S. economy, and it's the subject of my third book, Restoring Our American Dream, The Best Investment. And that one, General Brent Scowcroft wrote the foreword. Terrific. And then P.J. O'Rourke wrote the afterword. My very dear friend, P.J., God bless him and keep him. And God bless and keep General Scowcroft. They were great friends of mine, no longer with us. So now we're going to turn to Alan Schweier and see what he thinks about what's going on with the workforce and what he's studying at the conference board and how he thinks it's going to move the economic needle. Welcome, Alan.
Hi, Michael. Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it and love to talk about this stuff and agree with you that, you know, the differentiator for companies and for nations is their people. And that's why we do so much work at the conference board around these types of studies to measure the sentiment of employees and what they're looking for.
So you measure the sentiment of employees. Tell me what those measures are showing, but tell me why that's important, the sentiment of employees.
Well, you know, it's important because I think some of the things you alluded to, that this is really what drives productivity. So the more engaged, the more satisfied employees are. We've seen really good evidence over the last 20 or 30 years that connects this very directly to outcomes, productivity, and business results. So we think it's important because employees are and workers are human, obviously. They're subject to emotions, and they can be fired up and willing to give their all, or they can be the opposite and go through the paces at work. So we study things like job satisfaction, and that's our most recent report. We found, Michael, that it's up again for the past 13 years.
Wait, job satisfaction's on the rise.
It's on the rise, but there's a really important caveat to that. It hit its low in 2010. So you can imagine the effects of the Great Recession still lingering.
Great financial crisis, right? That was a low mark, and people were not feeling particularly good. You know, I'm remembering the two things that come to mind as we talk about this. The old Dunkin' Donuts ad where they had the little fat guy with the mustache who used to robotically get out of bed and shuffle and go, time to make the donuts. Time to make the donuts. Like it was the last thing in the world he wanted to do, and he would always get happy when the customers would come through the door. Did seem a little too late. If your job feels like drudgery, you're going to take a drudgery approach to it, and that will affect your productivity. The Soviet Union used to say, workers used to say in the Soviet Union, we pretend to work and they pretend to pay us. So there's also got to be a certain element in here, Alan, of being satisfied with how much you're getting paid. You got to be a little excited that you're seeing some wage increases in here, too. How does all of this come together? And you said you had a caveat for us, so give it to us.
Well, first, the caveat is that even though overall job satisfaction was slightly up in 2023, we also measure 26 subcomponents of satisfaction, things like wages, as you mentioned, and 25 other things. Quality of your leadership, the culture. And every single one of those 26 subcomponents was down over last year.
Really?
It's the first time we've seen.
So the subcomponents are down and yet the overall satisfaction's up. How do you account for that?
Because the overall satisfaction question is separate. We don't average all the questions together to come up with the final number. We ask one question at the very end, overall, how satisfied are you with your work? And it was just slightly up, less than half a percentage point over last year. But the 26 components are also 26 questions. How satisfied are you with your wages? How satisfied are you with your leadership, with the culture at work, with your health benefits, and so on? And like I say, every one of those was down. So what we think is happening, just, you know, it's difficult to say, but to put it as succinctly as I can, is that people are happy to have a job. Things are starting to look, you know, we see news of layoffs, and even though the unemployment rate is still very low, many economists are predicting at least a mild recession in 2024. We're seeing pessimism in Europe with wars and in the Middle East with wars. There's a lot going on. So we think there's an overall general pessimism when this survey was taken in November of 2023. And that continues.
So the mood when it's taken is important. Alan, where I was going to go now and then is what does this tell you about the future prospects for the economy? Are you seeing enough of a trend that you are expecting sustained optimism here from workers? Is this going to move the economic needle? And what you're expecting based on these numbers? And then I'd like to ask you why you think we saw that surge in entrepreneurial efforts over the past 3 years, and the difference you think that might make. And we'll wrap right there.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. So let me, we'll get Harry to count us back in. Okay. So we can get a clean start for break for him, because he has to do all the editing here.
Okay. And we're back in 3, 2, 1.
Okay, Alan. So now this is interesting. So tell me, do we see enough of a trend here? What are these trends telling you? Are you optimistic about the U.S. economic growth? Do they give you any insights into inflation? Are there going to be more wage pressure based on this? Or if satisfaction's moving up, maybe we don't need to increase wages, huh?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's also important to note that satisfaction, we think, is plateaued and maybe is at risk. It might be down next year.
Ah, okay.
Because it's down across the 26 subcomponents. And we know from doing this from 1987, this is the oldest satisfaction survey in the country, and we have lots of trend data. We see that it tracks with the economy. So when things are bad with the economy, satisfaction tends to drop. When things are starting to look good, like they did after 2010, we get a 13-year run of increases in job satisfaction. That's interesting. Even the dip during COVID, where we looked like we might go into a recession for a few months, did not affect job satisfaction. In fact, job satisfaction went up 6 points between 2020 and 2023.
Wow.
So it's tracked with the economy. And for that reason, Michael, I can tell you that this should be, this employer should pay attention to this, especially if you believe in the wisdom of the masses, right? If we had 1,700 workers take a survey, they're showing some pessimism.
And what, okay, so they're showing some pessimism. What should that tell me to do as an employer?
As an employer, you have some choices, right? If the economy does stay strong and the labor market stays tight, you're going to see some pressure on wages. You're going to see some pressure on the financial elements of job satisfaction, as well as the non-financial, like culture and so on. If there is a recession and the labor market loosens and unemployment rate goes up, employers have traditionally stepped back on what they offer. They've reduced wage gains. They've reduced benefits. They've reduced their efforts on improving the culture. I think that's a mistake. If there is going to be a recession in the United States in 2024, it looks like it'll be mild and shallow. There's not much indication.
Is the conference board expecting a recession in 2024?
Conference board has predicted a mild and shallow recession in 2024.
Okay.
Nothing specific. But most economists have, at one point or other over the last 6 months, made the same sort of prediction. But that should not be enough to reverse the gains that employers have made in making the experience of work better for workers. As you said at the outset, Michael, talent and human capital is what differentiates organizations. And to step back if there's a recession and reduce the benefits that you're giving to your employers is to invite turnover when the recession inevitably, mild recession inevitably ends.
Right. You can't start reducing benefits to employee, and you can't start reducing comp in a tight labor market. So the only way that works is if the conference board is correct and you do get some sort of mild recession, that should coincide with an increase in the unemployment rate. And if there are more people unemployed looking for jobs, then you can pull back on your comp. Then you can pull back on those things, satisfaction be damned, because you have another employee willing to take that job. You have someone in the job workforce looking for the job, and the person you have who's dissatisfied can be replaced. If you don't have a ready replacement, you better be nice to the guy you have. We can say that this sounds very draconian and bloodless in my approach to it, but I assure you, economics is not called the dismal science for nothing. Hey, Alan Schwer is the principal researcher, Human Capital Center at the Conference Board. Alan, thanks so much for joining us on the Farcast.
Thank you, Michael.
Really appreciate you being with us. That's it, ladies and gentlemen, for another Farcast. As we cover Wall Street, Washington, and the world, we'll be back next week. Help provide some insights and help us all think a little bit more about the world in which we live and the world and economy in which we invest. I learn something every week. Hope you do too. Have a great weekend. Please share us on your social media. For Harry Jennings, our producer, everybody at Hightower Advisors, and Farr Miller in Washington, thanks for listening. I'm Michael Farr. See you next week.
That's a wrap on this week's episode of the Farrcast. We hope you've enjoyed the show as much as we've enjoyed making it for you. Thanks to our guests, Jim Labenthal, Dan Mahaffey, and special guest, Alan Schweier from the Conference Board. The Farrcast is produced by Michael Farr and Harry Jennings and comes to you weekly for free on all major podcast platforms, including Spotify, TuneIn, and Apple Podcasts. Stream past episodes as well as subscribe so you never miss a new one. We love reading all of your notes and try to reply to as many as we can. You can reach us at hjennings@farrmiller.com. Let us know any questions you have about past episodes or questions you'd like us to answer in upcoming shows. Take care, stay safe, and stay healthy. Thanks for listening to the Farrcast. Wall Street, Washington, and the world. Farr Miller in Washington is a group comprised of investment professionals registered with Hightower Advisors, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. Some investment professionals may also be registered with Hightower Securities, LLC, member FINRA and SIPC. Advisory services are offered through Hightower Advisors, LLC. Securities are offered through Hightower Securities, LLC. All information referenced herein is from sources believed to be reliable. Farr Miller & Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC have not independently verified the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Farr Miller & Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC and any of its affiliates make no representations or warranties, expressed or implied, as to the accuracy or completeness of the information or for statements or errors or omissions or results obtained from the use of this information. Farr Miller & Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC and any of its affiliates assume no liability for any action made or taken in reliance on or relating in any way to the information. This podcast and the materials contained herein were created for informational purposes only. The opinions expressed are solely those of the authors and do not represent those of Hightower Advisors, LLC or any of its affiliates. Farr Miller & Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC, or any of its affiliates do not provide tax or legal advice. This material was not intended or written to be used or presented in any way to any entity as tax or legal advice. Clients are urged to consult their tax and/or legal advisors for related questions.